forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. My guest today is Professor John D. Levinson. He's the Albert A. List Professor of Jewish Studies at Harvard. He's the author of a book called Resurrection and the Restoration of Israel, also The Love of God, Divine Gift, Human Gratitude, and Mutual Faithfulness in Judaism. So we're going to talk about, you know, his book, Resurrection and the Restoration of Israel, and a bit about his work. So welcome, John.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, Rich. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, no problem. Tell me a bit about your background. How did you get here? In Jewish studies and what you're working on today?
Well, when I was in college, I was an English major. I remember my father, may rest in peace, saying, well, that's a good thing to major in because you already speak it. You know, if I was going to major, let's say, in Chinese, how far would I have gotten in 4 years? But then my passion was existentially and intellectually in Judaism, increasingly as my college years went around. So by the time I was about to graduate, I made a complete field shift and went into to study the Hebrew Bible, Northwest Semitics, ancient Near Eastern studies. And ever since then, that's what I've taught at various institutions now for going on 50 years. I mean, you don't have to do the math, Rich. I probably was, I don't know, minus 10 when I started.
That's funny. You're Methuselah's descendant. Maybe that's what you can tell people. So,
yeah, or if not Methuselah himself.
You know, the Bible, there's many things. Some people are into biblical prophecy. Some people are into, you know, let's say pottery. What's your focus and particular interests in regards to the time of the Old Testament and, you know, what's in the Old Testament?
Well, my main focus is, I would say, twofold, literary and theological. How the text is constructed, the artistry of this text, including both narrative and lyric, and for that matter, even legal texts, and theological, by which I mean the history of the religion of Israel, the religion that's internal to the Bible, the religion that's internal to the Hebrew Bible, but also the way it's appropriated and carried on and reinterpreted by its descendant religions, principally Judaism and Christianity. So the history of biblical interpretation and what the Bible has meant in post-biblical Judaism, especially rabbinic Judaism, and to some extent in Christianity, that's a major focus of my work as well. I'm not primarily a historian in the sense of political history. I'm not primarily interested in archaeology or material culture, although I think those things are relevant. I am interested in language and linguistics, and the grammar and historical development of the Hebrew language, its relationship to languages that are closely related to it. But primarily, I'm interested in the text and the way it communicates meaning and what its meaning is, and how that meaning changes over the centuries in the minds of people who are adopting and appropriating and reinterpreting this text.
Yeah, okay. You know, for instance, I've heard, without knowing too much, you know, Hebrew was supposedly considered a dead language for, you know, 1600-1800 years until Eliezer ben Yehuda brought it back to life, but that doesn't seem to be accurate. What's who and where was Hebrew spoken? You know, was it pretty rare, you know, since the destruction of the Second Temple? Or, you know, when did Hebrew kind of take a back seat and not be around very much, or not, wasn't widely read?
That's a very good question. Certainly Hebrew seems to be around and well after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 CE. By the Romans. The Mishnah, which is the great early rabbinic collection of law, was promulgated in the early 3rd century, maybe 210, something like that, CE, under Roman occupation of the land of Israel. There's a lot of Hebrew in Midrashic collections of biblical interpretation by the ancient rabbis, ancient rabbinic comments on individual biblical verses, produced in the 4th, 5th centuries, maybe later 6th century. So in that sense, it seems to be around. It never died out as a scholarly language. It never died out as a liturgical language, a language of prayer. And as I say, scholarship, sacred study. There's a reason that people call elementary schools for Judaism, Hebrew schools, but as a vernacular, as an ordinary spoken language that ordinary people would speak day to day, it seems to have been eclipsed by Aramaic, maybe in the 3rd or 4th century, something like that. And so it becomes primarily a scholarly and liturgical language, a religious language, probably by some point in the, just before the middle of the 1st millennium of the Common Era. But there were Jews who wrote in it, who wrote new texts in it all the way through the Middle Ages, great law codes, biblical commentaries, commentaries on Talmudic law, poetry, some gorgeous poetry, many, many poems in Spain and Germany in the Middle Ages, written in Hebrew for an audience that obviously could read Hebrew. And there was also some scholarly interchange, you know, among people who could read and write Hebrew, right up until Ben Yehuda and people like him revived the Hebrew language. So it's very much alive today.
Well, I don't know if you've gone much into the New Testament. When did Aramaic have a prominent role, like, you know, around the time of Jesus, or did it have a prominent role in, you know, BC times, or when did it come to the fore? Or where did it come from?
It came from the Arameans, another Northwest Semitic group. It's related to Hebrew. And it's of the same general family, Northwest Semitic languages, but it's not a version of Hebrew. It's not a dialect of Hebrew. It's a related language. English and Dutch are related languages. English and German are related languages. French and Spanish and Italian and Romanian are related languages, but they're not interchangeable or even necessarily mutually comprehensible to each other. So Aramaic becomes dominant probably in the time of the Persian Empire, late 6th century BCE. It's around before that. There's old Aramaic a couple hundred years before that. But it becomes dominant from maybe the 6th century BCE, let's say, I don't know, 550 BCE, 500 BCE. And as I say, it has its Christian version, which is called Syriac, and it has its Jewish version, a number of different Jewish dialects and, for that matter, Christian dialects of Aramaic. And there are still a few small communities, unfortunately, tending to be displaced today in Iraq and Syria, who still speak versions of modern Aramaic. That's a language that never totally died out as a vernacular either, or I should say never totally died out as a vernacular. But those are rare, and those are small and embattled communities of Christians in Arabic-speaking countries who probably speak Arabic as well, but who also control Aramaic as their native language, modern dialects of Aramaic as their language. Aramaic was kind of the lingua franca, to use a kind of a strange term, the international language of most of the ancient Near East in the late 2nd millennium BCE and much later.
Why was it so widely used? It became from a single source.
That's a very good question. It has to do with political factors. It has to do with the eclipse of other powerful ancient Near Eastern languages and the empires that spoke them. The eclipse of Akkadian, which was the language of Mesopotamia, the Semitic language of Mesopotamia, language of ancient Babylonia and Assyria, which in a certain sense were replaced, Babylonia in particular, by the Persian Empire, which spoke an Indo-European language. Persian is related to Sanskrit or Greek or Latin or, for that matter, English. But Persian was not the international language of the Persian Empire. That was really Aramaic, which could be understood very widely. And so it got on, and these other languages died out. And by the 1st century CE or so, Akkadian basically is dead, and Aramaic is very widespread throughout the Near Eastern and Eastern Mediterranean world.
Yeah, it seems like even in the 1st century, Greek became very important, I guess, for trade. What was the interplay, you'd say, of Greek and Aramaic and Hebrew at this time? Romans, and then they speak Latin. What languages were in play, and how did they work each other out at this time?
Well, around 332 or so, Alexander of Macedon, Alexander the Great, defeated the Persian Empire and took over lands of the Near East, including ultimately Egypt, Mesopotamia, and so on. So those lands all became part of Alexander's empire, which then split into many parts. So Greek became a prestige language. You know, it's been said, what's the difference between a language and a dialect? I think Max Weinreich, the famous Yiddishist, said this. The difference between a language and a dialect is a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. And the army and navy that won was Alexander the Great's. And so you had a kind of Hellenization process in the ancient Near East, not dislodging other cultures, but augmenting them, reinterpreting them, challenging them. And Greek became a very prominent language in the Eastern Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire. Even when those lands were controlled by Rome, the dominant language of the Eastern Roman Empire was not Latin, it was Greek, not necessarily the level of or the same character as classical Greek, as Greek from the 5th or 4th century classics of Athens, but it was a very prominent language, and of course it continued to exist. It became Byzantine Greek, and it continued to exist and exists to this day in Greece. But there were Greeks and Greek-speaking people, and much more widely spread in the Eastern Mediterranean and Near Eastern world than simply in Greece. So what you're really getting at, Rich, is we have a kind of trilingual situation in that late temple period or early rabbinic period or early Christian New Testament period, all same thing, which is to say Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and you have inscriptions and literature in all three of those.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
So, I mean, the languages, I guess even today, they kind of split. Sometimes, you know, certain religions, faiths will use certain languages. You know, like the Muslim faith, they appear to preach in Arabic, even in countries that don't speak it. Like, let's say Pakistan, they speak Urdu. You know, here in the U.S., I guess they had the Latin Mass for the Catholics for many, many years until maybe 67 years ago. Now it's English. You know, so was Greek used for commerce? Was it used for faith? Was it used for everything? Like, which languages were relegated to specific uses? It seems like Hebrew was very, very specific for a long period of time, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, Hebrew was, as I say, a vernacular probably into the second or third century, especially in the land of Israel, less so among Jews living in Babylonia or elsewhere. A major Jewish community existed in Egypt at the time, and probably did not have much command of Hebrew. But I think Greek and Aramaic would have been used for all kinds of uses, including commercial exchange and documents of various sorts, including by Jews.
The Old Testament, I mean, was it really actually all written in ancient Hebrew, or was it written in other languages? And then its final version that became the collected works, you know, was all in Hebrew and was standardized. Like, how do you think it was first written down?
Well, you have to remember the Hebrew Bible. I'll use that term rather than Old Testament. Old Testament's a fine term, but it's a Christian theological term. Old Testament is unique to Christianity and presupposes a certain Christian canon, a certain Christian theology. But the Hebrew Bible is not 100% Hebrew. You have to remember the Hebrew Bible developed over the course of maybe 1,000 years, maybe from something like, I don't know, 12th century BCE through the mid-2nd century BCE, about 1,000 years, and developed slowly, and there was a kind of sense of a rolling corpus, as it's been called, of texts that are written and revised and redacted and combined and all kinds of complicated processes that biblical scholars love to try to reconstruct. So, you know, that it's almost completely in Hebrew. There are 2 words of Aramaic in Genesis. There's 1 verse of Aramaic in Jeremiah, and large amounts of Aramaic in Ezra and Daniel. And other than those exceptions, Hebrew is the language of the Hebrew Bible. But it changes over time, as any language changes over time. English is very different now from what it was 1,000 years ago, or for that matter, 200 years ago. So we're dealing with a situation of linguistic change. And to some extent, biblical scholars can date text according to the language, or at least we can try to. Early biblical Hebrew, classical biblical Hebrew, or standard biblical Hebrew, late biblical Hebrew. There are certain words and constructions and syntax and so forth that helps us date these texts. So, but the short answer to your question is the Hebrew Bible is mostly in Hebrew, probably 95%, and I would guess in Hebrew, but a Hebrew that changes over time. And it's, of course, not identical to Hebrew today, just as Greek is not identical to Greek 2,000 years ago, or English is not identical to English 1,000 years ago.
But even within, you know, the Hebrew Bible, how different is the Hebrew? Let's say Book of Job versus, you know, one of the final books.
Oh, now that's a very good question, because you picked Job as an example. Job is a very hard book. I'm not talking about the prose, prologue, and epilogue. In other words, the first two chapters of Job, which are in prose and pretty easy to read for a student of biblical Hebrew, or the epilogue, which is to say Job 42, 7 through 17, which is also prose. But that poetic section between those two, starting at chapter 3 of Job and going all the way through, let's say, the beginning of 42, that is pretty hard Hebrew with a lot of rare words and strange constructions. It's a real challenge to the philologist, to the scientific student of language, to the Northwest Semitic scholar, of Northwest Semitic languages. So Job is almost like a kind of idiolect or distinct language to itself, but it is still a Hebrew. But generally speaking, between early sections of the Bible and later sections, there are distinct differences, but they're not completely different languages. And of course, we don't know for sure how widespread any given word was, how widespread any given grammatical construction was, because we have very little in the way of epigraphic evidence, in other words, inscriptions from ancient Israel. We have some, I mean, people spend their lives studying these, but compared to the amount of literary evidence we have from the Bible, we don't have much. So it could be words that we call rare happen to be rare in the Bible. Maybe they weren't rare in the spoken language at the time. We don't really know.
Okay. Where did combinations, I've heard there's a language called Ladino, it's a mixture of Hebrew, and I forget what else. There's a bunch of these mixtures. What are they called, or where do they come from?
They call those Jewish languages. Ladino is, I understand, is Old Spanish, written, but a Jewish dialect of Old Spanish, medieval Spanish, and it's written, as all these Jewish languages are, in the Hebrew alphabets, in what we now call the Hebrew alphabet. So it's not the same as contemporary Spanish. It was spoken by Sephardic Jews in medieval Spain, and then when they were expelled from Spain in 1492, a larger number of them went east to the Balkans, areas like today would be Turkey and Yugoslavia and places like that, and maintained Ladino. Ladino is today also a threatened language because most Ladino speakers have emigrated either to the United States or to Israel. And so it's hard to keep up a minority language when you no longer have a geographical base. But for hundreds and hundreds of years, people spoke Ladino, and some people still do. And there are still some singers and who produce songs in Ladino. Yiddish, I don't know if you're interested in Yiddish. Yiddish is a...
Yeah, I grew up in New York, so yeah, I know.
Yeah, Yiddish is sort of like the equivalent of Ladino, but in the Ashkenazic world, in the world of Northern Eastern Europe, a Germanic language. The deep structure of it is Germanic. It, again, is written in the Hebrew alphabet. The grammatical structure is Germanic, but there are many Hebrew words in a distinctive pronunciation that have come into Yiddish. Slavic words were words from Eastern Europe, which is where Yiddish was eventually primarily spoken. That was the world of Poland and the general Eastern European world. Many words from there came into Yiddish as well. And there are others, there's Judeo-Arabic and various languages like that, which represent the languages of people Jews who lived in those lands, wrote those languages in a Hebrew script, but also had a very distinct dialect. Just like you might have, let's say, in American English, you might have a distinct Black dialect or Black form of speech that people could identify. And people may say, well, that's substandard or whatever. But at one level, it may be. But at another level, it simply simply reflects a sociological difference. Who is speaking this? Now, imagine something like that were written in a distinct alphabet, right, that was not generally shared by other English speakers. Then you'd have a rough analogy to what Yiddish or Ladino or any of these other Jewish languages are all about.
Okay. And looking at all these languages and attempting to place them in time, what appears to be the first language that has been discovered? And in addition, what is Hebrew's place in that? Is Hebrew the first?
No. Well, I don't know what the oldest language discovered is. I guess the oldest language discovered is probably some form of Sumerian, which is an unclassifiable language of Mesopotamia, or of Egyptian, which is not what's spoken in Egypt today, or of, Akkadian, which is the Semitic language in Mesopotamia, and therefore a cousin to Hebrew and Aramaic and Arabic. But what linguists do is try, historical linguists try to reconstruct proto-languages. In other words, anybody who would look at English father and German Vater, or English book and German Buch, would immediately say, or Latin Pater for father, would immediately say, well, these all are evolutions, out descendants of some proto-language. Let's try to reconstruct the proto-language. In that case, proto-Indo-European, or if you just go with German and English, proto-Germanic, something like that. With Semitic languages, people try, what is Proto-Semitic? Into what language could you resolve Hebrew, Aramaic, Phoenician, Ugaritic, Arabic, Akkadian? What language stands behind them? Those proto-languages are hypothetical. They're reconstructed, just as someone might reconstruct your ancestors based on your genetic profile and your cousins and your third cousin's genetic profile without ever having met the person and can't actually be 100% sure what the person was like. But they could try to reconstruct their general genome or whatever. Here, I'm way out of my depth since I don't know anything about genetics. But you see my point. What the first human language was, no one knows, because there are major families of languages, the Semitic languages, the Indo-European languages. I haven't even talked about India or the Niger or Congo languages, I think they call them. Yeah, like there are 1,200 of those languages, and many different languages in East Asia, and for that matter, in the Western Hemisphere, and Native American languages. So could you take those proto-languages and put them together and reconstruct the ultimate proto-proto-language that the first person said? That would be very, very conjectural. First person spoke, that would be very conjectural and very hypothetical, and but there are people who try to, but say I don't. But that's what people try to do.
But it's, you know, if you assume that the Hebrew Bible is correct, that the Tower of Babel, or you know, Babel was where the languages really were first created, and geographically, you know, I believe we know kind of where it's located or was located. Couldn't you start there geographically and look back and date, you know, to the levels of, let's say, 3,000-4,000 years ago, and see what language appeared to be there at that time? Would that give a clue, or would it still be murky?
Well, that presupposes a kind of, what should I call it, literalistic historical reading of the Tower of Babel. That's an actual, reliable historical account of linguistic diversity, and that there was such a place, and that's how it all originated, as opposed to an attempt by certain ancient Israelites to account for the fact that people are spread out all over the world and can't understand each other. So, I mean, that is true that before modern biblical criticism, for modern history, before modern science and linguistics, there were people who just assumed Hebrew must be the original language. After all, Adam and Eve are speaking Hebrew. What more do you need? But no serious academic historian of language reads the text that way or takes it that way.
Okay. I understand. So let's move on to, you know, at least one of your books, you know, the one that we were going to talk about today. You know, what's the background, the history on, you know, resurrection and the restoration of Israel? What's the premise of the book, and where did that come from?
Well, Resurrection and the Restoration of Israel is a book I wrote about 18 years ago, still available in paperback. And the idea is, I think that the notion of a resurrection, the resurrection of the dead, is extremely important in Judaism and the ongoing Jewish tradition. And there are a lot of misconceptions people have about resurrection, the resurrection of the dead. I thought I would write a book to trace its history, how it developed, and its status as a Jewish doctrine, and modern objections to it, and why so many modern Jews attempt to move away from it, or more likely are just ignorant, just don't know about it. And so I thought I would disabuse the public of some misunderstandings, and at the same time enlighten the Bible and early rabbinic literature, and even to some extent later Jewish literature, as to this particular doctrine. I mean, the first misunderstanding people have is, oh, Jews don't believe in resurrection. Now, I think one reason for that is when the average English speaker hears the word resurrection, he or she thinks of the resurrection of Jesus. If you say the resurrection in English, people think that's the return of Jesus after he's dead, reported in the Gospels. So they, well, the Jews don't have that. They deny that. That is already a considerable misunderstanding, because resurrection, I guess with a small r, without a definite article, refers to a particular expected event. In other words, it refers to the intervention of God, to put it crudely, to reanimate corpses, to resuscitate people who really have died. And this was part of Jewish eschatology, of the expectation in certain Jewish circles, not all, in certain Jewish circles of, let's say, late Second Temple times, there's third, second, first century BCE, first century CE, and so forth, and afterwards, the expectation of what would happen at the end time. And in rabbinic literature, the normative literature of which all forms of modern Judaism descend, it became a defining doctrine. In other words, they deny a place in the world to come for people who deny the resurrection of the dead. Tachiyat HaMetim, it's called in Hebrew. So the general resurrection of the dead is an idea that was held too fiercely by certain Jewish sects. And as you know, Richard, Jews have a lot of sects, but many people don't know that because they think of it as distinct to Christianity, or they even think it was introduced by Christianity, etc.
You could make a joke. You could say, why are Jews so happy? Because they have a lot of sects.
That's exactly right. But some Christians have more sects than Jews. I got to tell you that, Rich. But the next, I think there's something like 33,000 Protestant denominations. So if you call those sects, which maybe is not the right term, Protestants have an awful lot of sects, Rich. But anyway, back to the subject here. And resurrection of the dead is different from something else, which I also point out in the book, Resurrection and the Restoration of Israel. It's different from the immortality of the soul. The immortality of the soul presupposes something like this. You are not limited to your body. Your body will die. But the real you is an invisible, indestructible core that we can call in English the soul, and it survives the natural death of the body. That is to say, if God forbid your legs were amputated, you wouldn't be half the person you used to be. You'd still be a full person. You're just
right.
Body would weigh half of what it used to. And so the notion is the immortality of the soul. The notion behind it is simply this indestructible core that the body is all that dies. But the resurrection of the dead is something more. The resurrection of the dead is an event. It's God's intervening at the end of time to do a miracle, something that is scientifically impossible, namely to reconstitute the dead people and bring them back in their full personhood. If you want to use a dichotomy of body and soul, which is not a dichotomy native to the Hebrew Bible, then you would say that he brings them back in body and soul. They don't just come back as a spirit, a disembodied spirit. They don't come back as a ghost. They come back as an embodied person, because their bodiliness is part of their creaturehood. Their bodiliness is part of how God created them, and he will recreate them at the end of time. And in fact, in the second book of Maccabees, which is a book not canonical in the ongoing rabbinic tradition, but written by Jews in the late Second Temple period, they actually refer to the doctrine of creation as validating the resurrection of the dead. If God can create the world in the first place, he can create you in the first place, he can recreate you after you're dead. Being
right.
Effectively just various chemicals, he can recreate you at the end of time. But that's different from just the immortality of the soul, because it presupposes a belief in an active, intervening God and intervening to redeem the world at the end of the time and bring people back in their bodiliness and their full personhood from the dead. So that's a critical difference. But I have to say that in Judaism and Christianity, as I understand Islam as well, the resurrection of the dead and the immortality of the soul, both those doctrines coexist. There's an unnecessary mutually exclusive, exactly where you are, what you are, when you die and your soul goes to wherever, to God or to wherever it goes, but before you're resurrected. That's a little hazy, especially in Judaism. But nonetheless, there is a notion that that's not the end. The end is not simply the soul enduring somewhere disembodied after death, but the God will intervene and bring back the people who have died.
Okay. So I have a question, I guess, about the rabbinic literature. How many periods of time was there a whole bunch of rabbinic literature? From what I understand, like during the Babylonian captivity, you know, like 580 BC, there was a bunch of rabbinic literature. And then again, the Midrash, I guess, 50 BC to 200 AD. And then again, the Talmuds, a few hundred years after that. I don't have a good understanding of it, but how many periods and times were there?
That's also a very important question and a hard one to answer. When does rabbinic tradition begin? The term rabbi, rabbi, or rabban, particular sort of rabbi, seems to have emerged in the middle of the first century of the Common Era. But rabbinic tradition traces its origins back to figures who lived well before that, you know, from even hundreds of years before that. And ultimately, it makes a claim that it was revealed on Mount Sinai, that their teachings, the teachings of the rabbis, were somehow revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai and handed down orally generation after generation. But historically speaking, as responsible academic historians would look at it, rabbinic Judaism seems to have begun to take shape some point maybe late in the first century BCE, and then to have most of what we call classical rabbinic literature was written, or I should say taught and eventually written down, sometime between the middle of the first century of the Common Era through maybe the 6th or 7th century of the Common Era. That's when the Mishnah and the Talmud and the classical Midrashim and the Tosefta and some of the key liturgical texts were all composed. But, you know, just as it's hard to say when did the rabbinic tradition begin, because it's hazy, it's unclear, it's also hard to say when did it end, because the easy answer is it never ended. There are people to who certainly devote their lives to the study of this literature, which is an important Jewish mitzvah, an important commandment and kind of sacramental act in the Jewish tradition. And there are people who do this and are respected as sources of Jewish laws, as valid judges of Jewish law, poskim, they're called valid judges, rabbis who are extremely conversant not only in this ancient literature, but in the interpretation and application of it in Jewish law codes over the last two millennia, who still do this. So that says the rabbinic literature, rabbinic Judaism, never died out. It's still around to this day. It's the ancestor of all forms of Judaism that you see today.
Was there like a renaissance in this writing? It seems like it was condensed into a particular period of time. I know it still goes on today, but why was there a surge of it at certain time periods, you think?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it was a very, ultimately, the rabbinic movement, whatever its origins, took over pretty much all of Judaism by the 3rd, 4th century of the Common Era. One hesitates to overgeneralize, but other forms of Judaism that did not know rabbinic teachings, did not know or denied this whole concept of oral Torah, of oral law, whatever reason, they pretty much died out. There was a movement that later on, towards the end of the first millennium CE, that challenged rabbinic Judaism from within, a kind of anti-rabbinic movement from within the rabbinic tradition, Karaism it's called, which was a certain vague ways analogous to a kind of a Jewish Protestantism. In other words, we're going back to the Bible. We don't believe in all your oral teachings and all your interpretations and so on and so on. And it was very prominent in the Middle Ages. But today, there are very few Karaites around. Some still around, but very few Karaites around. So why does it surge at certain times? I don't know the answer to that. It certainly depends in part on historical circumstances, challenges that emerge, a fear that certain teachings will be lost under the impact of persecution or whatever. And so they feel a need to collect the material, to publish it, eventually to print it when the printing press is invented in the 15th century, and to prepare new law codes that synthesize vast amounts of decisions and previous law codes. All these things depend on complicated and in some ways unpredictable historical circumstances.
Yeah. Okay. We're getting close to the end here. What questions are you wrestling with at this moment? Like, what's the newest, latest, greatest things that you're considering?
Oh, I don't think anything I'm considering is necessarily new or late or great. Coming out in the end of June, my Eisenbrunn's Press, which is a imprint of Penn State University Press, called Israel's Day of Light and Joy, The Origin, Development, and Enduring Meaning of the Jewish Sabbath. There's a book on the Sabbath is coming out by Penn State University Press, Eisenbrunn's imprint, at the end of June, God willing. And there I deal with the whole origins and development of the Sabbath, as the subtitle would indicate, and also what it might mean today, and the whole question of, to a much lesser extent, Christian observance of the Sabbath. And even towards the end, I even touch on the subject of the digital Sabbath, unplugging the technological Sabbath that some people in the contemporary world are advocating. So that's been my latest project in recent years. You know, Rich, I've been working on the Sabbath for many years. In fact, there were periods when I worked on the Sabbath 6 days a week.
Okay.
That was actually a joke. But anyway.
I know. Well, you know, it's funny, a lot of the things you said, they did have a couple of meetings. You know, I was working on the Sabbath, working on it literally, working on
exactly.
It in self-understanding. Yeah, I get
you. Yeah. I didn't think of it, yeah. No problem.
Well, very good, John. What's the best way for listeners to find out more about your work? Should they start with a particular book? Should they? Is there a website to go to? Like, how can they find out more?
I know there's a website. You can always use Amazon. I mean, I can name some of those books if you wanted me to.
Sure, yeah.
Well, I wrote one called Inheriting Abraham, the Legacy of the Patriarch in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. That's Princeton University Press. My name is John, J-O-N. There's no H in that. last name Levenson, L-E-V-E-N-S-O-N. There's no I in that. And that deals with the attempt of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam to claim the figure of Abraham and the whole category, and analyzes and to some degree problematizes the whole idea of an Abrahamic religion. I have another more elementary or simpler book I wrote about 44 years ago, called Sinai and Zion, an Entry into the Jewish Bible. And you mentioned my other book with Princeton University Press, The Love of God. And another one, Princeton University Press, was Creation and the Persistence of Evil. And then there was a book that Kevin Madigan and I put out together, which is a kind of, it's like Resurrection, the Restoration of Israel, but a little different. It's called Resurrection, The Power of God for Christians and Jews by Kevin Madigan and John Levenson. And it deals with resurrection in Judaism and Christianity and the interactions of that doctrine or that expectation in those two great traditions. So I guess I could mention all those, and they should all be available on Amazon or maybe in your local library.
Okay, well, very good. Well, John, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a very interesting call, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for the good questions.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.